Hey everyone, this is Elijah Johnson with financeandliberty.com, and back with us today, a returning guest, James Corbett from the Corbett Report. James, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Elijah.
All right. Well, I'd first like to discuss a little bit about the Federal Reserve. Now, you recently reported that the former head of AIG actually recently sued the Federal Reserve over the Fed's unconstitutional actions in the 2008 AIG bailout. And the really interesting thing is that in this case, the Federal Reserve actually got off without a penalty. And you stated that, quote, "The ultimate precedent from this ruling is that in a time of emergency, the Fed can do absolutely anything it likes, including violating the Constitution, and absolutely nothing will be done about it." Did you want to explain this situation?
Yes. Well, for people who don't know about this court case, it's technically number 11-779C, and the plaintiff in the case was Star International Company on behalf of two classes of shareholders of AIG via the United States. So the U.S. government was named as the defendant in the case, but this was revolving around the Federal Reserve's actions in its bailout and emergency lending facilities that it extended to AIG in the wake of the Lehman collapse that amounted to $182 billion of emergency lending facilities and other programs, special purpose vehicles and others that they add up as the official AIG bailout, but altogether, it came to over $200 billion. But as part of that deal, the Federal Reserve actually took over basically control of the company. They took, I believe, 80% of the controlling shares of the company and began running the day-to-day operations. And so it was Star International Company's argument. And of course, Star International Company is headed by Greenberg, the former head of AIG itself, who was ousted in an accounting scandal several years ago, but he is still one of the the largest single shareholder was Star International, which he headed. So Maurice Greenberg's argument was basically that the Federal Reserve, well, it was twofold, one of which was that the Federal Reserve actually violated the Fifth Amendment in extending this loan facility at the expense of taking over the shareholders, or at least 80% of the share voting shares, and basically said that that's a violation of the Fifth Amendment clause against nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. The other aspect of that is that he also argued it was in violation of the Federal Reserve Act itself, and Section 13, Subsection 3 of the Federal Reserve Act specifically allows for the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve to create special lending facilities and for individuals, partnerships, and corporations, but does not allow them to take over control of those companies in exchange for that lending. So that was the argument, and that was what was heard by the court. And ultimately, the court's ruling, which came out just about a week and a bit ago, was pretty straightforward. It says, upon a full consideration of the record and arguments of counsel, the court finds that the Federal Reserve Bank of New York's taking of 79.9% equity ownership and voting control of AIG constituted an illegal exaction under the Fifth Amendment. So it did violate the Fifth Amendment injunction against taking private property for public use without just compensation. The Board of Governors and the Federal Reserve Banks possess the authority in a time of crisis to make emergency loans to distressed entities such as AIG, but they did not have the legal right to become the owner of AIG. In the Federal Reserve's history of making hundreds of emergency loans to commercial entities, the loan to AIG represents the only instance in which the Federal Reserve has demanded equity ownership and voting control. There is no law permitting the Federal Reserve to take over a company and run its business in the commercial world as consideration for a loan. So again, that's directly from the ruling that was issued by Thomas Wheeler in this case. Pretty straightforward. The Federal Reserve overstepped its boundaries. It broke the law. It violated the Constitution itself. And what penalty was exacted from the Federal Reserve for this illegal maneuver that it performed in the wake of the Lehman crisis? Well, absolutely nothing. The ruling goes on to say, based upon the foregoing, the court concludes that the credit agreement shareholder class, i.e. the shareholder class that was damaged by this takeover, shall prevail on liability due to the government's illegal exaction, but shall recover zero damages. So absolutely no penalty. Yes, they broke the law, but nothing's going to happen. So it's a pretty straightforward example of how the Federal Reserve is and will remain above the law. And basically what this ruling states is that in an emergency situation, the Federal Reserve can do whatever it wants. It can take over companies. It can break the law directly. It can violate the Constitution even. And ultimately nothing will come of it. So I thought that was an interesting ruling for what it says with regards to the Federal Reserve. It's also interesting because it's a window onto AIG generally, which is a group, an American international group, an insurance, one of the largest insurance companies in the world, the fourth largest by market cap, that not a lot of people really understand or know what it is, and that it is really, in many ways, an adjunct of the American intelligence apparatus. And that's not just something that has to be speculated about. It was revealed in documents that came out about a decade and a half ago that from the World War II, when the founder of AIG was collaborating with Wild Bill Donovan, the founder of the OSS, which eventually became the CIA, one of the things that he was collaborating with the OSS on was providing insurance agents. There was a cadre of insurance agents who were actually acting as spies for the US and the Allies during World War II, because, of course, insurance agencies have all sorts of information on people, all sorts of data that they can use in the event of warfare or economic warfare or what have you. So there's some just fascinating history around AIG. And I think the interesting bit of excluded history when we look at this case is the fact that Maurice Greenberg, Hammer and Hank, as he liked to be known, was in fact himself a director of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And it's interesting, all of the coverage I've seen of this case, no one actually pointed this out. He was in fact a former director of the FRBNY, and now he's suing them and going through this show trial, because ultimately all it amounts to is allowing the FRBNY to get away with it. So what was really the point of this? I don't know. I mean, I don't know the inside skinny, but it just seems to me that if you wanted to set some very, very bad case precedent, you would launch a court case like this and get the ruling that just came down. So I'm interested in this story for a lot of different angles. But of course, one of them is the fact that, as I say, the Federal Reserve is officially above the law.
Right. And did you want to expand a little bit on what this means for the future actions of the Federal Reserve, that really, as you're saying, it seems like the Federal Reserve can do absolutely anything it likes now?
Well, I mean, let's put this into perspective. The 2008 Lehman crisis was, of course, a very precarious situation because it threatened to expose the trillions, perhaps quadrillion dollars, the estimates vary because no one knows for sure, of derivatives that are floating around in the banking system and that are threatening to go up in flames in the event of any sort of systemic crisis like what we saw developing in 2008. So that had to be prevented at all costs. And as a result of that, the Federal Reserve just got carte blanche to do whatever it wanted. Now, imagine if such a situation were to play out today. It would not only be as bad as the Lehman crisis, I would venture to say it would probably be worse. The threat of systemic worse is much, much greater now after the QE era than it was in the pre-QE era. So we are likely to see, in the event of any sort of systemic crisis hitting again, and I think that's not just a likelihood, but an eventuality, when that does happen again, now we have this actual court precedent that the Federal Reserve basically can do what it wants, that it will not suffer any damages whatsoever from doing what it wants, that there will be no real legal recourse or kickback to its actions. And that's when I think we have to think about the type of systemic crisis that could arise. And basically, the precedent that's now been set, the legal precedent for federal entities like the Federal Reserve to start nationalizing industries. And again, I mean, this bears on what we've already seen with the GM bailout and things of that nature. But imagine how much more acutely this could happen in the event of the next crisis. And that's what I think the legal ramifications of this decision are.
Speaking of this nationalization by the Federal Reserve, is it really true to say that the Federal Reserve is nationalizing these organizations? Because isn't it true that the Federal Reserve, I mean, this is kind of I guess this can be disputed somewhat. It's kind of a controversial thing. Some people disagree about it, but it really, the Federal Reserve isn't, strictly speaking, part of the government. So is it really nationalization? I mean, some people say the Federal Reserve because its stockholders are the banks, you know, the nation's banks. It's really, in a way, owned by the nation's banks. So what is really happening when the Federal Reserve takes ownership of an organization?
Well, that's a very good question, and I think it goes to the confusion that is sewn into the very DNA and fabric of the Federal Reserve itself. And I think we have to differentiate. There are a couple of different entities here. There's the Federal Reserve system, presided over by the Board of Governors, and then there are the Federal Reserve banks, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and the other regional banks that comprise the Fed banks, as it were, the banks of that system. So the system is more or less a political entity that is appointed by the president. For example, the governor is appointed, and there is more of a political status to that board and the system overall, which was enacted by an act of Congress and could be repealed by an act of Congress, I suppose, if that was ever to enter the political sphere. But the banks themselves are private entities. They are corporations, and that has been argued by the Federal Reserve's legal counsel itself. I have a clip of that in my Federal Reserve documentary, Century of Enslavement, with the legal counsel admitting and arguing in court, no, the Federal Reserve banks are private corporations. So I think it's telling that in this case, this particular case, it was Star International Corporation v. the United States government, because under Section 13, Subsection 3 of the Federal Reserve Act, the Federal Reserve System is granted the authority to provide these emergency lending facilities, but only with the prior approval of the Secretary of the Treasury. And of course, we do know that the Secretary of the Treasury was very much involved in this. At the time, it was Paulson, of course, the former head of Goldman Sachs. No surprise there. But yes, he was very much involved with this and obviously did give prior approval to the AIG bailout. So in that case, it was very much a U.S. government initiative, as it were. Regardless of the status of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York as a private corporation, it was obviously done with U.S. government approval and prior approval, which makes, I think, the U.S. government liable for the actions that were taken here.
All right. Well, I'd like to move our focus now to another topic. Another thing that's in the news right now is the Greece situation, the Greek debt crisis. Did you want to outline for our viewers maybe the new news we're seeing from Greece, and what is your perspective on this?
Well, I don't want to get too much into the news because as we record this, this is, of course, still a developing story. It looks like they are coming to some sort of emergency deal. We do know that some emergency lending was extended to the Greek banking system last Friday. That would be Friday, June 20th. I believe last Friday, anyway, the 19th, there was some emergency lending that was provided to the Greek banking system, which is a very temporary stopgap measure against the incredible amounts of withdrawals that are taking place in Greece right now. And of course, now we have not only reports that the Greek people are storing thousands of euros each under their mattresses, sometimes quite literally, as a precaution against a type of Cyprus event. But we now also have reports that banks are unofficially limiting withdrawals to 3,000 euros per customer. So definitely some worries about the Greek banking system and its ability to prevail through this ongoing crisis. But it looks like they're coming to some sort of temporary agreement that might be extended. And there have been some concessions apparently made by the ECB itself with regards to the pension haircuts that were supposedly part of the hinge on which all of this recent crisis was resting. But again, that remains to be seen. But I think one of the interesting developments that's coming out now and that's been just reported on by Zero Hedge, they're pointing out an interesting release by Goldman Sachs that are speculating on the fact that the crisis may actually be in the favor of the ECB. So the European Central Bank may actually desire Greece to exit the Eurozone at this particular stage, because it would, in this new normal that I think we've talked about in our previous conversations and I've noted before, this new normal of central banking pronouncements dictating economic reality for the rest of us in a way that has never been quite so straightforward before. Now we have central bankers coming out and initiating various QE programs or what have you, and the markets respond, or even the idea that the Federal Reserve might raise interest rates become something that drives markets. Well, in this new normal, now we have the precedent that if Greece were to exit the Eurozone, that would give the ECB and the Bundesbank, which is really underlying the recent Eurozone QE program, the incentive and the political leverage over their own populations to basically extend and expand the current Eurozone QE program, which means that they could hopefully, in their view, put a lid on the contagion of the Greek crisis with basically papering it over with a flood of Eurozone QE. And so they might actually desire Greece to exit now in this short, sharp, harsh cutting out of the cancer, I guess, as they would see it, from the system, in order to basically paper it over with QE and thus contain it. And as Goldman points out, that would bring the euro down to parity with the dollar, and that's probably where things would stabilize. So it's an interesting theory. I'm not sure that is necessarily what's happening or what they would want, but it is certainly an interesting take on it. And I think it does speak to that reality that, again, we've talked about before, that we are now entering this world where all of these macroeconomic and microeconomic factors really do hinge now on the pronouncements of the central bankers. And basically, as long as they can get away with it politically, they will do all sorts of QE and whatever types of radical lending needs to take place in order to basically paper over the problems and keep the lid on this spreading contagion, this fire that's threatening to rip apart the Eurozone. So we really are looking at make or break time for the Eurozone, regardless even if they do reach a deal with Greece or they don't. I think this really is going to define the way the Eurozone proceeds from here, the way that they respond to this crisis. And I think obviously it would be very easy for them to basically take the Federal Reserve route and just try to amp up the bond purchasing that they've been starting with this new Eurozone QE and try to see if they can just create a new economic reality by central bank fiat.
Now, you've also talked on your website about the Turkstream pipeline and how this seems to be a sign that Greece is actually possibly aligning with Russia. And how does this all play in with the Greek debt crisis?
This is extremely important in one sense and perhaps not important in another. So let's differentiate the two senses. I think this is extremely interesting for what it portends geopolitically. As an actual on-the-ground economic reality, I'm going to remain skeptical and agnostic until it actually happens. For anyone who actually follows these pipeline deals, the only sure thing is that there is no sure thing. And until it is actually physically wired in on the ground, it's not really, you can't really bank on it. And even then, it's interesting how even when these pipelines are wired in and start forming these hardwired networks between countries, suddenly we have these independence movements or terrorist networks, depending how you look at it, springing up in the very sectors where these pipelines are being built. And as a prime example of that phenomenon, I would point people to the port of Gwadar in southwestern Pakistan along the Arabian Sea coast, which is a prime area for Chinese involvement. In fact, China took over operations of the port a few years ago because it provides the perfect entry point onto the mainland from Africa for all the oil and gas that they're shipping up from Africa. On the shipping containers, they'll bring them in and they'll basically start a pipeline network to pump it in through the port of Gwadar up into China through Pakistan. Well, suddenly in that region, we now have this Balochistan freedom movement that, of course, I think it really does exist. And there are Balochis who do want to separate from the Pakistani government for their own reasons. But it's interesting, this particular freedom movement has become the cause célèbre of various Congress critters and George Clooney and the Council on Foreign Relations and these types of entities. Well, why are they getting involved? Clearly because, well, this is a very geopolitically sensitive area and it's a way to undermine Chinese interests and all of that, you know, geopolitical wrangling. So as I say, even if this Turkstream actually does come into reality, and that's still not really decided at this point, but even if it does, it'll be interesting to see what comes along to perhaps put a kink in that plan. But having said that, again, for people who don't know, basically the Turkstream was the idea that came up in the wake of the cancellation of South Stream, which was a plan to have an underwater pipeline across the Black Sea connecting Russia at Baragovaya in through Bulgaria and then in through Romania and Hungary and other parts of Eastern Europe as an alternative route to the current gas pipelines, which, of course, take the gas from Russia through Ukraine into Eastern Europe. Now, obviously, Ukraine has become a very uncertain pipe route for Russia to continue its energy flows into Europe. So they had announced the South Stream to bypass that. That got canceled because of European Commission meddling. Basically, they put an end to that. They said that couldn't proceed because of various economic reasons and violations of certain European policies or what have you. But really, that was just as a way to undermine South Stream so that the EU, US, NATO approved pipeline, the Nabucco pipeline project, could get a leg up. Well, Russia came out immediately and said, well, we're going to do Turk Stream. So it's basically the same idea, but instead of going in through Bulgaria and Romania, they're going to go from Russia to under the Black Sea again into Turkey, and then through Turkey, through Greece, and then into Eastern Europe. So Greece now becomes a very central player in this Turk Stream pipeline project, and potentially garners a lot of economic and geopolitical benefits from this, which is why it's very interesting that right at the height of this crisis, we have Alexis Tsipras going over to St. Petersburg to meet with Putin, and as part of that, discussing and signing an agreement on this Turk Stream project. Again, I don't know if this Turk Stream project is going to actually happen. They're saying they're looking at a construction by 2019, and I forget how many billions of cubic meters of gas they're planning to have pumping through there. I believe it's 47 billion cubic meters of gas a year they're hoping to have online. Again, I don't know if that is actually going to happen, but the fact that these talks are taking place right now, right in the midst of the height of the Grexit panic, is geopolitically very interesting. So, of course, we have now people coming out and saying, well, you know, obviously this shows that Greece is turning towards Russia, and oh, well, what can we do? Which I think is very much illustrative of something that Mark Faber was pointing out a few weeks ago, which is that basically NATO will not allow Greece to leave the EU because of its strategic importance, its extremely geostrategic location. They're connecting, obviously, Turkey and with Europe. It's just a part of the map that NATO could not possibly allow to fall into more Russian-friendly hands. So that's why he thinks Greece will basically not be allowed to leave the euro. And I kind of agree with that assessment. I think that what we're seeing right now is just some geopolitical angling. So I think Tsipras might be playing into that game by trying to get a little bit more leverage from the EU by flirting with Russia. And the more he flirts with Russia, the more the EU will realize they can't let Greece go. I think there's a bit of that going on here as well. It will be extremely fascinating to see how this plays out. And who knows, maybe even Turk Stream will actually come online. And that will obviously throw a lot of different monkey wrenches into the works when it comes to the calculus over Ukraine.
Well, I'd like to discuss now a little bit about, I know in our last interview, we discussed how the US and China are actually, you've said, are working together toward global governance. And I was wondering if you had any updates on this that you wanted to share with our viewers.
Well, I would say that there's no update in the sense that I don't think there's been any real alteration to that fundamental plan. But I think it's important that we define our terms carefully here when we're talking about this thesis, because it is not my thesis that the U.S. and China are working together towards global governance. Specifically, there are certain elements within the financial slash political slash business oligarchy in the U.S. who are collaborating with specific interests in the financial slash political slash business oligarchy in China in order to bring about a shared vision of global governance. And again, even within that framework, it doesn't necessarily mean that every single person involved in that is cooperating in the sense that they think that this is going to be a shared joint venture. There may still be elements within there that think that they're going to get ahead in this deal. But ultimately, the end goal is very similar, which is to have international institutions and a multilateral framework undergirding the economic and monetary reality of the 21st century in the way that the United States ultimately dominated the 20th century. So basically a new Bretton Woods. And I think there are players on both sides of the US and China divide, quote unquote, that are actively working towards the creation of that reality. And again, I think divide has to be in quotation marks there, because again, I think the nation state framework that you and I and everyone we know tends to see the world in is not the same framework that these oligarchical elite live in. And I think we've as you say, we've talked in our previous conversations about this framework and who is involved. And for example, the 1980 meeting with Rockefeller and Rongi Ren of CITIC in Chase Manhattan's headquarters that involved 300 prominent Wall Street and financial businessmen collaborating with China to start basically the process of building up the Chinese infrastructure. And we've talked about those elements of it. So again, none of that has fundamentally changed. But towards the creation of that global governmental system, there's been some interesting maneuvers in recent months. One of them, for example, that I pointed out in an article back in March, the fact that China is now starting its basically alternative to SWIFT, which is the SWIFTNet, Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunication, which is the network that handles the transmittal of financial transaction data between banks internationally. It doesn't actually clear those payments, but it does make those, it's the network upon which those payments are sent. And it is the standard for banks to be connected into the international banking community, which is why SWIFT was used to boycott Iran during the height of that crisis. And so the several Iranian banks were delisted from SWIFT, and it was a big deal. So basically, China has taken the initiative of creating its own SWIFT alternative that's going to process transactions internationally in yuan specifically. So another peg in the charting the rise of the yuan as an international currency. And another story that's come up recently, in fact, just in the last couple of weeks, that's interesting along those lines. We talked before about the great Holy Grail China-Russia gas deal that was signed between the world's largest gas exporter and the world's largest importer, that should have been signed probably a long time ago, economically speaking, but was held off because of various geopolitical rivalries. Well, they, of course, China and Russia did sign that deal last year. And at the time, we noted that if this was going to be denominated in yuan, it would be potentially a game-changing event. But it seemed at that time that it was going to be denominated in dollars. Well, we just got a very interesting pronouncement in from the export CEO of Gazprom, Elena Burmistrova, saying that the sales contract on the gas itself is not signed, so the currency of payment has not yet been determined. So now they are actively looking at discussing what currency it will be traded in and potentially actually settling the deal in yuan and rubles. And since this will equate to something like 30 billion cubic meters of gas a year, it's not necessarily economically the most, you know, world-shaking thing that's ever happened. That's a relatively small part of the global gas market, let alone global energy markets, let alone global international trade. But as a precedent, it's extremely interesting. So if they do ultimately end up settling this deal in yuan and rubles, that's another huge blow, I think, to the dollar as the world international reserve currency. And then compounding that is the fact that later this year, the IMF is going to make its decision on whether or not the yuan will be included in the special drawing rights basket. I wrote an editorial about that in the International Forecaster a few weeks ago, what the special drawing rights are and why this will be significant. But the long story short is that the special drawing rights administered by the IMF are increasingly being proposed as a potential alternative to the US dollar as a world reserve currency, that one of the currencies that central banks will want to hold in their reserves in order to settle international trade imbalances. And so that would be another huge step if China is included in that special drawing rights basket. And now we're seeing the stage being set for some sort of back and forth between Washington and Beijing on this issue, with Washington supposedly is going to be dragging its heels and trying to prevent this. But do they have the clout on the IMF board itself to actually stop that decision from going ahead, et cetera, et cetera? He said, she said, kind of two-dimensional geopolitics, as I've pointed out before, whereas the three-dimensional geopolitics that we've identified before of the quest towards more international multilateral institutions dominating the world economic and financial and monetary markets is, I think, going ahead exactly as planned. And it's not something that's going to happen overnight, but it is something that is happening as we speak, and the dollar is being eclipsed as the world reserve currency. At this point, all things being equal, it is only a question of when it will be officially taken over as the world reserve currency.
Now, before we let you go, I was wondering if we could touch on one last subject, and mentioning that the dollar is weakening and that other currencies such as the yuan seem to be moving forward. in Texas, it seems like gold seems to be taking a step forward. The state of Texas actually has now a state bullion depository. Did you want to discuss a little bit about this? I know you said in an interview that this could actually be the first step to secession.
It could be. I'm not saying that this is a step towards secession, but at any rate, if you wanted to actually secede from the United States, I think this would be a necessary step towards that, to have that kind of financial and monetary distance from the United States that I think would be necessary in order to do that. Again, I'm not saying this is what's happening, but it's an interesting move, especially when we put it in light of the Texas secession movement. But this is an interesting story because it's the type of story that absolutely makes sense on every level, and it's just plain rational sense in this, especially in this age, not only of the fiat dollar currency that of course has prevailed for a very long time, but specifically as things begin to get more and more insane at the federal level, when we look at the QE program and now the raising, the potential rate hike that everyone's bracing for, and all of this uncertainty and insanity on the markets on the national level, but also, of course, internationally, as we talk about with the U.S. dollar potentially being eclipsed in the future as world reserve, it only makes sense that states would want to try to get this type of bullion depository down to the local level. Again, for people who don't know about this, Texas has just passed a bill that will allow them to establish a bullion depository that will be used to not only allow people to make deposits of actual bullion, but to then trade those deposits in the same way you would trade the credits in your deposit account at the bank. So exchanging with other people at that bullion depository via electronic transaction or whatever. Basically, the creation of not an alternative, but maybe a complementary currency system that's actually backed up with actual physical precious metals. That's an idea that makes perfect sense in these extremely volatile times of very much systemic uncertainty. One would only think this would be normal. The only thing surprising about this story is the fact that it is actually happening, because, of course, so many people have been lulled into a false sense of security over the last several years that I don't think a lot of people necessarily see the need for this type of institution. But I'm glad that it is going ahead, and I hope that it is emulated elsewhere and starts to become more of a phenomenon than it is right now. And perhaps we can see this as piecemeal of the repatriation movement of various countries that are trying to repatriate some of their gold from the Fed, like Germany and others. Perhaps this is part of that, because one of the factors in this creation of this depository is that some of Texas's gold holdings at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York are apparently going to be repatriated to Texas to reside in the local state depository. So very interesting move. We'll have to see what ultimately comes of this, but it certainly makes a lot of sense from every level.
Well, James Corbett, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your time with us. I guess before we let you go, did you want to share with the viewers where they can find you and if there are any last thoughts you might have to add?
Absolutely. Well, the best place to find me and my work is CorbettReport.com, CorbettReport.com, and all of my work and all of my videos and interviews and podcasts are up there for free download, so I hope people will take a look at that. Also, I do put out a subscriber newsletter that helps to fund the website, but the editorials in that newsletter are available for free on the International Forecaster website, theinternationalforecaster.com, so I hope people will go there and subscribe to The Forecaster if they are interested in that publication. Lots of information coming out through there as well on a weekly basis. And yes, I mean, there's just so much going on that I don't know. I don't know where things are heading next, but I do know for certain that it's going to be a very interesting year to see how things play out in Europe and with China and the US and with NATO and Russia. There's so many things happening right now that it's impossible for anyone to keep track of all of them. But I'm going to do my best. So I hope people will follow me, and thank you for having me on.